This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Back from a week of Thanksgiving gluttony, but no more about that. If you are a leader in Egypt, where we begin today, there are a lot of nearby images, convenient images, actually, of absolute power kicking around, whether it's King Farouk from the 1940s, followed by Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 50s, Anwar Sadat, later military leader Hosni Mubarak, or even out there on the horizon, the pyramids of the pharaohs. Is Mohamed Morsi, by granting himself sweeping new powers less than a week ago, taking a page from this long Egyptian history of absolute rulers? Well, the Egyptian president says he's taking on greater power to supervise a process that will eventually give him less power as the difficult transition to democracy continues in Egypt. President Morsi meets with the country's Supreme Judicial Council today, where judges will try to convince the president to retain some checks and balances on presidential power. Joining us from Cairo is reporter Noel King. Welcome back to the show, Noel.
Thanks so much, John.
So is this a negotiation that's going on here, or who's talking to whom with any sense of power here?
It is absolutely a negotiation that's going on here. And like many things in Egypt, it is happening behind closed doors. So we don't exactly know what the terms are of this agreement that they're trying to come to. But what we understand from Morsi's camp and from the judiciary is that they're attempting to hammer out some sort of deal that allows Morsi, without embarrassing himself, to back down off of the most controversial parts of this very controversial decree issued on Thursday. And of course, the most serious part of that, as you've mentioned, is this decree that gives him effectively sole authority over Egypt. Now, we're expecting some sort of announcement, or hoping for some sort of announcement this evening, that will suggest that both sides have cooler heads have prevailed on both sides, and that Morsi is going to back off. Now, interestingly, it might not be enough, and here is why. You know, Egypt's secular left has been waiting in the wings since Morsi was appointed to the presidency. They've been waiting for him to mess up. And the reason for that is they are credited with sparking the Egyptian revolution, but they gained almost no political power from it because they were divided by backstabbing and infighting. And they've watched from the sidelines as the Islamists, including Mohamed Morsi, have risen to power. Now, what they're calling for in Egypt tomorrow, which is really worth taking note of, are massive demonstrations in Tahrir Square to re-grasp the mantle of the revolution. And what they're saying is, no matter what agreement Mohamed Morsi comes to with the judges, unless he revokes this decree in its entirety, which he's not expected to do, we are going to hold demonstrations tomorrow and we are not going to back down, trying to present themselves, of course, as some sort of unified political front.
Although the numbers are against the secular left in Egypt under any circumstances, despite their passion, yes?
You know what the answer to that is? I've asked them the same thing today. The numbers were against them in the beginning of the Egyptian revolution in January 2011 as well. They're hoping for something of a repeat tomorrow, but without the ongoing delays and without some of the violence that we've seen over the past few days.
Reporter Noel King in Cairo. And let's get another voice now. One of the many people we spoke to in Egypt last year during the course of the Arab Spring was Omar Khalifa. Omar runs Egypt's O Media. He's a publisher there. He gave us the memorable quote, "Democracy is like medicine. Take too much in one go and it'll make you sick." A few moments ago, he joined us once more from Zamalek near central Cairo.
When I spoke to you last time, I told you that democracy wouldn't work the way that people see it, you know. And it will take a lot of time, and we need a smooth transition of power to avoid what's happening right now.
Do Egyptians really care if there's another dictator, this time Mohamed Morsi versus, Hosni Mubarak? I mean, does the lives of the people of Egypt really change?
I mean, under Mohamed Morsi, nothing has changed. Maybe with what he's doing right now, things are getting even worse. But people do really care. They do really want democracy. But these things, they take a lot of time, especially that in our political system, it's very, it's a presidential system, not a parliamentary system. And the Muslim Brotherhood have been waiting to grab the power for almost 80 years. And I think they'll be a lot harder to remove from Mubarak.
Do you think that Egyptians are willing to give the Brotherhood a chance to go it alone so that they don't have to deal with these Mubarak holdouts in the judiciary and in the military, and that they get their shot since they were elected, and then we'll worry about democracy later on down the line, or no?
No. I think that when Mubarak was still in power and he was about to leave, and even after he left, a lot of politicians came out and said, maybe the Muslim Brotherhood, people are exaggerating to which extent they are going to ruin the country or be extreme. They gave them the chance, and too soon he's grabbing all the power that no other president got, you know.
a cynical view there from Omar Khalifa. Let's get even more cynical. Is it possible that people on the streets in Egypt believe that Morsi negotiated this Gaza deal with the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and got some sort of tacit arrangement? I'll work this out in Gaza for you if you let me just sort of become a dictator in Egypt. And people believe Hillary Clinton might be behind this?
No, I think the whole thing with the Muslim Brotherhood, I think it's just they wanted in the very beginning, they've just been a few months in power, they want to make the U.S. comfortable and the other Western countries comfortable, you know, that they want to act like a peacemaker. But as they have hidden agendas in the interior politics of the country, they, of course, have hidden agendas in the foreign policies, you know. And at the end of the day, they are part of Hamas, you know.
Omar Khalifa runs Egypt's O Media. He's a publisher there in Cairo. Omar Khalifa, good luck and thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
In the end, he said, they are just a part of Hamas. That's Omar Khalifa. Well, let's get another voice here. P.J. Crowley is former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, now a professor at George Washington University. P.J., welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, John.
There's a temptation to say, here we go again, in the sense that there are lots of leaders that the U.S. has worked with who have at various times declared emergency powers. And the U.S. has had to cope with that over an extended period of time. First of all, what do you make of the Morsi decision and what kind of precedent it has in contemporary history?
I think this is something that we probably should anticipate, not just in Egypt. There's been a transformation, but this is an institutional struggle between an executive with uncertain powers and a judiciary that is dominated by holdovers of the Mubarak regime. We should anticipate that as they go forward towards something that resembles democracy or representative government, that there are going to be steps forward and steps backward. So this, I think, is a continuing process in Egypt that has evolved over the past year and still has some distance to go.
We're talking with P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. Let me give you a couple of examples from history that I suspect you know pretty well here. And I'm going to play a couple of clips of tape of some voices that might be familiar to many of our listeners. They might be hearing them for the first time for some of our listeners. Here's the Argentinian absolute ruler in the 1980s, Leopoldo Galtieri. He took power after a military coup. Here he is speaking.
El gobierno argentino y el pueblo argentino, este cabildo abierto, puede enardecerse y presentar a las ofensas.
A passionate Leopoldo Galtieri announcing the war over the Malvinas Islands, the Falklands War, that the British, led by Maggie Thatcher, won. And here's President Mugabe in the days after he was elected in a very similar sort of spring-like democratic movement when Zimbabwe was actually created. Here he is.
Our main concern should now be to join hands in building our country so that we can create a new Zimbabwe with a new national faith, a new national love, binding all its people.
A new Zimbabwe became the absolute rule of Mugabe, which continues to this day. P.J. Crowley, what do you make of the Argentinian example of the 1980s and then, of course, the more recent example of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe?
I'm not sure that there are direct parallels. One has to understand with Morsi that the dictatorship or the ruling by decree is necessarily a temporary measure in and of itself. But as your prior interview suggested, the real issue here in the challenge is how inclusive and how transparent will government be in Egypt going forward? And there are legitimate concerns about the emergence of a constitutional assembly that is heavily dominated by Islamists, to the point that institutions in the future in Egypt may not work.
Let me push back a little bit there, PJ, in the sense that every one of these leaders, Mugabe, Galtieri, and I could name others, and Mohamed Morsi, is betting that the people of their nation will tolerate this emergency for some period of time. And in the case of Zimbabwe, it's gone on forever. Galtieri only had a couple of years. How much time is Morsi betting he's got by the weariness of the Egyptian people?
Well, I don't think you can separate Morsi from the broader movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and how politics will shape its future. I mean, it's one thing to be a long-term opposition, a secretive society, but all of a sudden, when you have to govern, perspectives change. And I think Morsi is going to be somewhat tempered by the fact that Egypt requires external assistance, including significant assistance from the United States to regrow its economy. If it can't regrow its economy, it's not going to succeed as a political movement. So even while we should rightfully be concerned about, even for in a temporary phase, the absence of meaningful checks and balances, over time, I don't think we should underestimate the impact that politics is going to have, in these movements as we see these dramatic transformations and transitions from Egypt to Tunisia to Libya and Yemen.
Although the Egyptian state of emergency after Anwar Sadat was assassinated lasted 30 years, there's almost an institutional sense of the military coming in and sort of mopping things up whenever the civilian leadership goes awry in, say, Turkey and Pakistan. Are we heading in that direction in Egypt?
Well, actually, John, I think it's interesting that you mention Turkey as a parallel. I do see parallels there where, for example, with the Erdogan government that is in existence now. And as we can celebrate the fact that the Erdogan movement does signify the potential to marry, Islam and democracy. Nonetheless, there are indications, particularly in Erdogan's treatment of the press, his war against the military, if you will, that we should be concerned about some excesses within the Islamist movement in Turkey, even as it exists within a broad secular a political sphere in Turkey. Nonetheless, you have in Turkey, or had for a long time, the military as a guarantor to protect against excesses. And while we have seen here that the military in Egypt has been remarkably quiet, during this past week, nonetheless, it serves as a potential counterbalance to the excesses of emergent civilian politics in Egypt.
Institutionalized absolute rule by decree. P.J. Crowley taking us through history there. Thanks so much, P.J.
All right. Pleasure, John.
P.J. Crowley is former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. He teaches at George Washington University. And, of course, we want your take on anything you hear on this program. Over the Thanksgiving holiday, as you gathered with family, we asked if any family secrets made their way to the dinner table this year. Diane Patrick uncovered some history in her family. My mother died when I was 8. I never knew my father, even though I am a master researcher. I didn't attempt to locate my father's people until I was 40 years old. What I learned was that my paternal grandfather was a taxidermist who worked on the elephant that stands in the entrance of the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in D.C. Wow. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. Coming up, political lessons from Obama taken in Massachusetts. We'll talk about that in a moment.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.